Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Insightful, fun conversations with some of the best LGBTQ writers from around the world. The Illusions Podcast.
I'm Matt Warren, Mr. Dave, Two Scoops Martino. You're moving up. See, I've got raisins on my mind now. It's going to drive me nuts now. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You're just going to have some raisin bran.
Yeah, I'm going to be staring at that box. It'll be staring at me, eyeing each other down, trying to decide how many raisins are in this box.
Yeah, you're going to have to measure it all out.
Yeah.
Count them by hand.
You're right. I should make a TikTok video out of that.
You should.
Several, right? Because you can't get it done in 60 seconds. Right? That's
viral.
Too many raisins. Yeah. Be crazy, and then who's going to stop me from eating them?
Yeah, that's the thing. You have another video of you just eating them.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you're not on there. I can't find you anymore.
Well, I'm there.
No, your name in. I've typed it in.
Really?
To link you to the shows and stuff, and I'm doing because the ones that and it doesn't.
Did they get rid of me?
Yeah, because you don't even come up. Period. Oh. I can't even find you.
They kick me off.
Yeah, you're getting too violent. You've gone too far with all that karate stuff, right? They just like, no, this is too much.
That's it.
Yeah, you've been canceled.
Swinging around sticks and yeah.
You've been canceled.
I'll have to check on that later.
Yeah, because you're not on there anymore. I can't find it. I typed it in over and over, and I even double checked to make sure I had the right spelling. I put in David, Two Scoops, Martino.
That's why you can't find me.
It doesn't come up. So you have to create a new account. Just call it Two Scoops.
Two Scoops. Okay.
Well, speaking of scoops, we've got a writer back, and he's dragged himself out of bed. It's early. He's in Australia, and and that's not down under because the world's flat, remember, so it's just kind of to the side. He's got a book out, Bridge at the Beach, and it's part of his Clyde Smith Mysteries, and let's see, it's book number 4. So, Mr. Garrett Jones, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. For you.
Oh, well, good evening, good afternoon, whatever.
Yeah, it's all the same. Doesn't matter. So you're still writing. But before we get into the book, how's life been for you? How's everything going? What goes on in a day of Garrick Jones' life?
Well, you see, I live in a coastal town in the tropics in Australia, so I'm less than 5 minutes from the beach in the middle, and the town that I live in is in the middle of the Whitsunday Island chain. So we have lots and lots of deserted coral beaches up and down the coast. So I often get up and go for a walk down the beach, have a swim. Even in the middle of winter, it's still really, really warm here. So I walk on the beach, sit under a palm tree, read a book, write notes, come home, clean the house, play with a cat, do some gardening. Then rest of the day's writing, really. Now that I'm retired, it's a very comfortable life.
Oh, sounds like it. Sounds kind of like a hard life. I mean, we should start up maybe a GoFundMe or something to help you out there. You know, it's terrible.
I could really do some with some yard help, so that GoFundMe might help. You know, get a big, strong gardener in to do all the heavy work, heavy lifting.
Yeah, then take him for a swim. but that's a different story. So Clyde Smith is back at her again.
Yep. Book number four.
Yeah, book number four. So I don't know if I've asked this before. So your relationship with Clyde Smith, does he direct how many books he's going to do? Does he come at you with...
He does, but also the series is... I wrote two series. I don't know if you remember. One, this Clyde Smith series, and another World War II sort of spy thriller series.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Clyde Smith series is really, really popular. I get lots and lots of requests saying what's coming next, when are we going to have the next Clyde Smith book? And so it's really driven by not only my interest in investment in Clyde, but also in the readers. Everybody wants to know more about him. And I really like him. I mean, he lives in an area that I grew up in and in a time that I grew up in. So the surroundings are very familiar, and for me, it's been a very good way of working out, making a lot of positive things out about some really unhappy parts of my early life. So I find it really therapeutic writing about him, and also I really like him. He's a nice guy.
Well, there you go. Well, are you thinking of the reader as you're writing?
Yeah, I think that it's sort of Clyde comes naturally. When I started to write the second book, I thought, how am I going to sort of get into the character again? But I think if you ask anybody who writes a series, the characters invest themselves within you. So they become part of you. So it becomes easier and easier to write about them the more that you do. I think there's a lot more books in to come in Clyde's series. He's got a great story. He's got a great background. He's an interesting man. He's not two-dimensional. He's got a lot of problems. He struggles with his relationship. He struggles not being a detective in the police force anymore. He struggles with his past, with his war buddies. He's a complex man. He's great to write about.
Well, I can't remember if I asked you this before. Do you hear your characters? Is that how you write their dialogue? And do you hear the prose, transcribe?
I hear the prose, I hear the voices, and I see the action. As you know, I spent 30 years on the stage as a performer. So when I'm writing, I actually see things in terms of movement. So I see the characters moving around and where they are in relationship to each other and what motivates them to do things. So we rarely just do things out of the blue. There's always a reason behind why anybody does anything. And I like to explore that because it gives us an insight into their personalities and, their motivations, why they do things. So, I see it three-dimensionally in my mind as I'm writing it, and I hear their voices. And one of the reasons I've found it very difficult to think about getting a book, an audio book version, is getting the right voice for Clyde in my mind. Also, it's damned expensive.
In a way, when you're writing these stories, it's kind of being told to you. Is that right?
It's more being living it, I'd say, rather than being told to me. I sort of like live through the characters while I'm writing them. So I feel inside myself when I'm writing each of them, because it's a continuing story, and there's about five main people apart from Clyde around his life that are in all of the books. And I easily slot my mind into each of those people and live their lives while I'm writing about them, thinking how would Harry, Clyde's partner, react when Clyde does all these really what they seem to be stupid things without thinking of any danger he could be in. And I get Harry's voice in my mind. I get his feeling of how irritating Clyde is, yet how much he cares about him and how much he's looking out for him. Yeah, so that's basically the process. I live the books as I'm writing them.
Well, when you live a process like that, when you're going through what your characters are going through, how does that affect you? How does that come out for you as the writer?
It's really, sometimes it can be really tough, and sometimes it can be really cathartic when you're writing about situations that resonate with your own life. I mean, most writers write from things that have happened to them, experiences, feelings and stuff like that. It can be really quite emotionally challenging. And I think that's a good thing. I think that you, even though this is less of a real life type thing, it's more sort of like pulp fiction style stories, you still got to make the reality, and sometimes living through that reality can linger with you. I often wake up in the morning thinking, oh God, I'm Clyde. Where am I? What am I doing today?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I was going to ask if Clyde and your other characters affect your daily life.
Yeah, they do sometimes. Yeah. But I spend most of my day, if I'm actually putting words on the page, I'm researching and stuff like that. So I have an escape.
Right. You go swimming with them on the beach.
Yep. But yeah. In fact, this book starts off with a scene on the beach. It's an interesting this story. I have Canadian friends who live here, an ex-colleague and his wife, and they play bridge a lot, and they have in a serious bridge club, and they have pals who live right down on the beach that they visit every Tuesday afternoon, and the four of them play bridge and socialise. And my friend writes to me. She said, "Oh, we're off to bridge at the beach this afternoon." And this has been going on for a number of years. And I thought to myself, geez, this make a great title for a book. So I just took the idea of Bridge at the Beach as a title. And then I evolved the story around the title, which is really quite unusual because usually the title comes later on in the process. So the whole story evolved around these friends of mine who play Bridge at the Beach. And I actually knew how it was going to end. I knew how the middle was going to go, but wasn't quite sure about the start. And I thought, okay, I'm going to kill off these four people while they're playing Bridge at the Beach, and that'll start the mystery off.
Do your friends know that?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. They see it as a bit of a tribute writing this book.
Oh, nice. So what's the basic premise of this? Like the four people die? Like give us the basic storyline.
The basic storyline, without giving too much away, is that Clyde's at the beach with friends having a nice day, and a local cop turns up looking for the detective at the local police station, who's a friend of Clyde's, having an afternoon off swimming in the sea. And he said, "I'm looking for him." And Clyde asked why, and he said, "There's been a quadruple suicide and this block of flats you can see." And Clyde knows the people who have been killed, and actually it turns out not to have been a suicide, that's not giving too much away, but a complex murder that revolves around a gem smuggling ring, extortion ring, criminals, and Clyde gets sucked into it. He's not in the police force anymore, but the two of the people at the party who have supposedly committed suicide are the parents of one of his childhood friends. And the childhood friend inherits a great deal of money from them and wants Clyde to investigate whether it's a real murder or a real suicide or whether it's a murder or not. And, of course, Clyde gets into huge trouble fighting responsibilities with the police force and getting told to keep out of the way all the time. And in fact, I wrote it as if it's two separate cases, one a domestic case of Clyde's, which has nothing to do with this other murder investigation on behalf of his childhood friend. But in the end, it turns out that they overlap, and in fact, both cases are all part of the same thing. It took a long time to write this because it's getting all of those two stories to meld together, mesh together, and then go back to the beginning and write them so that there's no plot holes, no false leads, but to make it work seamlessly at the end. Took a lot of time, a lot of energy, and so far everybody really loves it. The reviews and the feedback have been it's the best one so far. That's always music to any writer's ears.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you want it to keep getting better. What point of view do you write it from in this story? Do you write it from Clyde's point of view?
Yeah, it's first-person point of view. I write from Clyde. That also makes it tough because if you write in the third person, what they call omniscient view, you can then sort of like trot off into other people's heads and talk about things that happens that Clyde's unaware of. But writing it first person, you've got to be, it makes it more mysterious because there's a puzzlement all the way through. There's always parts of the and threads of the story that the main character doesn't know, as one would not know if you were actually that person yourself in real life. It's, I think it's challenging to write in first person, especially a murder mystery.
Right, right, because that needs the...
Because then the reader doesn't have any more information than what the main character has.
Right, that's interesting. Now, do you put a lot of violence in this, or you stay... How graphic do you get, and how... Like, how would you put this? Is it like a hard-boiled noir to a cozy? Where would it fit?
Oh, it's not a cozy. It's a hard-boiled noir. There's not... there is some violence in it, but it's not extreme that I can think of. Yeah, it's a typical sort of like 1950s noir crime thriller, but with a feel-good theme that goes underneath it. Clyde's happiness in his personal life and, you know, those of his friends around him, as we all do in real life. We have our work stuff, which is focused on something particular, but we come home and we have friends and family, and that's, you know, comforting. So at least he has that. He's not a lone wolf. Well, if he is a bit of a lone wolf, that he does tend to take off and do things without thinking, without letting people know, and gets himself into a whole lot of trouble.
When you go back to that time zone too, in the 50s, things were quite different. So when you say hard boiled too and stuff, are people kind of how they were in the 50s, or are you kind of sensitive to what people are reading now?
Oh, that's for sure. Well, I try not to modernise it. I make it, a lot of people say, why do you have so much smoking in your books? And I go, well, for heaven's sake, everybody had a cigarette in their mouth, you know, 24 hours a day back in the 50s. I mean, I grew up in that period. I remember it really, really well. And in fact, lots of the people in the book are based on people that I knew and family members and friends of family. So I've got a very strong memory of for what it's like, and especially the manners, the way that people related to each other. It's quite different than modern day. You know, there's a lot more formality and structure. People didn't really talk about some sorts of things. Lots of stuff was considered very private. So one of the frustrations in that period was that you didn't know a lot about what was going on because people didn't tend to gossip that much in case they got a reputation for being untrustworthy.
Right.
Yeah, I try to make it as very true to the period as possible, including the cars, the clothing, you know, what people did, what they ate, the lifestyle. I go through the movies because Clyde's a great movie fan. He writes a review in one of the newspapers on movies to supplement his private detective income. So he goes to the movies a lot, so I discuss, you know, what he's seen and the themes of those movies. He's also a cook. When he came back from the war, he was his father died shortly after he returned back, and his mother died while he was away. Had to learn to look after himself, and he'd been a prisoner of war initially, so he'd become very used after the war, and he stayed on to work to fight with the partisans, become used to Italian cooking, so adopted the language and the food.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Food, and then when he came back to Australia, went to an international cooking school to learn how to cook and look after himself. So he bakes, that's his thing. And only yesterday I had an email from a writer asking for one of the recipes in the book.
So you give them the wrong recipe, of course.
No. I write a daily blog on my author page on Facebook, and I wrote the recipe out and found a nice picture of it and published it. You know, now I've got more requests for other things in the books, especially his famous fruitcake recipe.
Well, how much artistic liberty do you take with your with what a PI can do in real life as opposed to fiction? Can you keep it realistic to the real world, or do you have to make exaggerations to make the plot work?
You have to understand that a private investigator in Australia is a completely different kettle of fish than what happens in the US. You're not supposed to have a gun, for example. Nobody carries guns in Australia. Even today, it's very difficult to get a firearm, and certainly not a pistol. So, but Clyde's kept his from the war, which a lot of servicemen did in the 1950s. I remember my uncle used to bring out his Luger that he'd taken from a German, and he used to clean it on the kitchen table when I was a kid. Showed me how to assemble and oil it and put it together. So yeah, that's a whole different thing. And of course, private investigators weren't actually licensed to work with the police, except in one state in Australia, but not the state that Clyde lives in. So he gets into hot water because he keeps crossing lines. He keeps getting visits from the local police, you know, asking him if he's withholding information or, you know, he. But fortunately, he's got a good pal who's the main detective at the station who looks after him a bit. Yeah, but so it took a lot of time to research what private investigators could do in the 1950s. And they were quite limited. They had very few powers, and they certainly got their asses kicked if they stepped into a police investigation and started asking questions the wrong way. So I try to keep it as true as possible. And I think that's probably the charm of it, because it's so different than the sort of Sam Spade American detectives that people are used to reading in US detective fiction.
And how much research do you have to do for something like that?
Oh, God. I can't tell you. The last book I wrote, The Road to Montepulciano, I probably researched that for about 6 months while I was writing other stuff before I wrote a word. And then Clyde Smith took, well, there was accumulated research from the three previous books, but other research on the gem smuggling trade in Australia in the 1950s was very difficult to track down. But fortunately, we have we have very good police liaison, public liaison agencies in this country. So some of them are very happy to do research for you and get back to you and let you know about situations and also point you towards particular cases. And then you can dig out the case files from the internet library files and read through and find out what happened. Yeah, I do a lot of research. I like to get it right because I tell you, if you get one thing wrong, somebody's bound to write to you and point it out. It always astounds me when people go, oh, he couldn't have done this on such and such a day because there was pouring with rain. And I go, well, you know, who the hell actually takes the trouble to look up the day something happened and find out what the weather was? But since then, I've got a calendar with the phases of the moon and weather reports so that I do get it right. I know that sounds a bit excessive, but I really want to know.
Yeah. No, it's crazy, but I do. I'm always going back to the dates and finding the papers and seeing what the weather was in the city and all that stuff. It's kind of crazy, but I'm insane, so that's...
Well, I think you and I are peas in a pod.
Yeah, it's just kind of, it's kind of crazy. And of course, it must be really tough because there's no way you weren't even close to being born in 1957. You're, you know, at least 10 years after that.
That's very, very sweet of you, Alan. I was already pubescent in 1957.
Oh, don't tell me. Don't say that. No, no.
Early onset of puberty.
Oh.
It actually horrified my family.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't as if they didn't think I was weird enough already, but have this 9-year-old sprouting hair and all sorts of other stuff. It was very, very weird.
Yeah.
And of course, I had this miraculous growth spurt from being, you know, 5'2" to 6'2" in the space of a couple of years. And everybody used to, when I got on the tram and I tried to buy a child's ticket, you know, the conductors would never accept it. I used to have an identity pass so I could, from the school, proving how old I was, so I could buy the 3-penny ticket instead of the 6-penny one.
Yeah. Well, there's advantages to being big and when you're young, too.
Oh, there are lots of disadvantages, too, let me tell you.
Yeah, I can imagine. You don't know where you're going to go with this thing either, do you? Like, it can go on for 20 books when you do a series, right? It doesn't really...
They're reasonably long books. They're all about 125,000, 135,000 words. So they're fairly substantial books. So they take a long time to write, I suppose, from putting the first word down to... the publisher giving the go-aheads, usually 12 months. It always takes me, that's writing full-time as well. This is not part-time, but writing every day. It usually takes me 3 months to write the first draft of a book, then another 3 months of writing, rewriting, before it goes up to the editor. And then there's more rewriting after that. So, yeah, it's not, although I seem to turn out 2 books a year, they're staggered over each other, if you understand. So while I'm writing one, I'm researching the other, or another one's being edited. For example, Bridge on the Beach only came out a couple of weeks ago, but the next World War book 2 is with the editor in the UK, ready to be published in November. And yesterday I started writing the first words of the sequel to The Road to Montepulciano. So yeah, keeps me going. What else would I be doing?
Right. How do you deal with the gay aspect of it and being in the 50s?
I actually wrote a blog about this. I was rather lucky. I had a very neglectful upbringing. But my godfather was gay. And he had a really interesting story, slightly digressing. He met his partner of 60 years in a dance hall in London during the Blitz. And Charlie, he's American pilot. There was a night when there's a place called the Rainbow Corner in London, which was set up for American servicemen to have social evenings, but lots of servicemen could go there. And lots of prostitutes used to turn up, and then they would pick pockets, and every so often they'd clear out the women and they'd only have, you know, men-only nights. And in those nights, the guys could dance together, and they were given armbands to put on for which role they played. So if they were dancing the girl's part, they would wear the armband, and then they'd swap it over so they could lead when they were dancing. So he met this Charlie there in 1942, and they lived together. And I grew up with them, and they had a circle of gay friends, and I grew up with them. So I was pretty well used to their private lives as opposed to their public lives, and the whole fact that nobody actually really knew. There was, in the 1950s, even when I was into the 1960s, there was this thing about people weren't out publicly as they are today. There was no, you just couldn't survive as an out gay man in that period. So yeah, I write about it. I'm very sensitive about writing it and not giving Clyde and his friends more social credit than they would have had at the time.
Yeah. It's you have to, I guess you have to tackle it in the right way.
Yeah, everybody sees it because we get so much fixation on the persecution and so many movies where people are persecuted and lonely and sad and they commit suicide and they get jailed and everything. But that wasn't all of it. You know, the thousands and hundreds and probably millions of men around the world went off and having normal lives and nobody knew what they were up to.
It's just, yeah, and how you can write about it and stuff. It's just a certain way because people reading now, there's young people now that, of course, would have no idea what really.
Oh, no, absolutely. And funny enough, even though, you know, I consider myself fairly up to date, there's still some things because of the way that I was brought up that I don't talk about to people, you know, that's private stuff. You know, no doubt that will change over time with other generations that come up. But, you know, the way that you're taught to behave and interact with other people, those social things are pretty hard to shift at times. I still don't say, when I meet people and say, hi, I'm Garrick. Hey, I'm gay to them. You know?
Right. Yeah, of course. Right. There's only.
I go through life thinking I'm just a bloke who happens to find other men sexually attractive, but it's not what defines me. I see myself as a man first of all, and then this other part of my life is my own business.
No, it's just in the younger generation, it's people like Dave that just get out there and just throwing things at people. You can't.
Well, I'll take the younger generation at least, but
that rainbow-colored lipstick gives it away every time.
Yeah. Yeah. Between that and a dress, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just a little bit crazy at times, but karate kid with a dress. But. So what do you hope a reader takes away from this book?
I rather hope they take away the enjoyment and a feeling of the period of in which it's written, which isn't all about noir and blackmail and doom and gloom. I mean, obviously that happens in my stories. I talk about, you know, people with these closeted lives in the 1950s who get into trouble. That's what happened. But it's not the focus of the story. I hope that they see that there was some light and love and happiness for gay men in the 1950s and that they were just normal people. A lot of them, you know, lots of the gay men that I met through my godfather and his friend had fought in the Second World War in both the Pacific arena and in Europe, and lots of them were decorated heroes and they were just normal men. That's the sort of thing I want to do in all of my books too, is to actually express the normality of who gay people are, that we're not just all getting into drag on the weekend or getting on pride floats, that we're judges and lawyers and brickmakers and plumbers and builders, and we just happen to go home at night and kiss somebody of the same sex when we walk in the door. That's what I hope to write about in all of my books, just that, you know, we're just people.
And so in your other series, so I was going to say, what do you got going on now? And you're obviously, so you're starting to work on the other series.
Yeah, this is the fourth book of the 7th of December series, which is the World War II series, is with the editor in the UK at the moment. That's set in, I've got to get my head back into where I'm in, 1942. It's about where America really starts to mobilise and we get lots of American troops starting to arrive in Britain, much more cooperation with the Americans during the war, and the main hero, main character, his work for the intelligence agency, which is masked by his performance as a violinist. So he's a violinist, but underneath he goes around working in intelligence stuff. It sounds a bit improbable, but it's based on a true story. Did you ever see The Catcher Was a Spy, that movie? This particular American man played major baseball league in the US. He had a PhD. He spoke 9 languages fluently. But while he was playing Major Baseball League, he worked as a spy for what was called the OSS, the American Wartime Intelligence Agency. So it's based on him, the character. A lot of people say, oh, it's so far-fetched. And I go, hey, go, just look at the biography of this man. And his name's gone right out of my mind because I've got my mind head so totally in Clyde Smith at the moment. But I preface the books with his story so that people can just check that my Tommy Hauptner, who's the main character in the 7th of December series, isn't one of a kind. There were a whole lot of really amazingly talented people who did things for the war effort secretly.
What happens to your character when you're not writing them or when the book is done?
If you could see my desk, there are books, notebooks everywhere with ideas for another story, you know, and research. I have to be really careful about the research because it's very easy to fall down the wrong rabbit hole. I can be researching a Clyde Smith story and I'll find something, this is really interesting World War II stuff. Hey, why didn't I know this before? This needs to go in the next book. So then I spend 2 or 3 days researching stuff which is nothing to do with the task at hand. But I suppose that's the beauty of really loving research. I mean, I really, it grabs me. I love it.
Okay, so let's talk about you and how people find you and what you've got going on. Website, social media, where do they find Garrick?
Yeah, I've got an author page on Facebook, which is my name with author, Garrick Jones Author. It's on Facebook. I post there something every day, usually something about where I'm at with writing, what I'm doing, what I'm researching, of course, the odd recipe now. Then the same thing happens on Twitter X, even though that's a bit of a graveyard at the moment. I post on there every day of what I'm doing, what's happening in my work in progress. Instagram, a couple of times a week, I do a post about one of my books, one of the back books, one of my books that needs a bit more attention. And I have a web page, garrickjones.com.au. I have a newsletter if you want to sign up to that. I send out a blog every so often, short stories, recipes from now on. The recipe thing is very popular.
Yeah, that's what I need. I need some new recipes here. We'll have all that posted up on the website as well as your book. And there you are. I mean, you know, appreciate.
Well, just to let you know that the Bridge on the Beach is out in paperback, ebook copy, and for the first time in hardcover. And it's a little bit more expensive, but I know a lot of people really like hardcover. It's expensive to produce, so if you buy a copy, make sure you buy an ebook as well, because I actually get really no royalties from the hardcover because it costs too much to produce. And then the next book, which is called The Perfume of War, which is the 4th, 7th of December story, will be out in October. So that's my plan. And 12 months from now, the sequel from The Road to Milpitanao, which I'm writing now.
Wow, lots going on, and, you know, we look forward to getting your hard copy, a hard one from Garrick Jones. It's always good.
There's not many people who can say that these days.
Yeah, that's right. Bridge at the Beach, and it's part of his Clyde Smith Mysteries. So, Garrick Jones, thank you.
It's always lovely to speak to you. Take good care, guys.
Thanks, Garrick.
I'll give you an Australian farewell. Hooroo.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.